Chapter 8. History and Cultures. The study of history is a powerful antidote to contemporary arrogance. It is humbling to discover how many of our glib assumptions, which seem to us novel and plausible, have been tested before, not once but many times, and in innumerable guises, and discovered to be, at great human cost, wholly false. Paul Johnson. History cannot provide direct answers to the quandaries of the present because there are too many variables that change between one era and another. But if history cannot provide answers, it can at least help in defining questions, and in some cases, it can utterly destroy theories which might otherwise seem plausible within the narrow confines of a particular time and place. History is an anchor in reality against the rhetorical winds of the zeitgeist. For example, one of the clearest facts to emerge from these worldwide histories of various racial and ethnic groups is that gross statistical disparities in the representation of groups in different occupations, industries, income levels, and educational institutions have been the rule, not the exception, all across the planet. Moreover, many of these disparities have persisted for generations or even centuries. The histories presented here are not the only ones illustrating the pervasiveness of distinctive cultural patterns and economic achievements. As the French historian Fernand Braudel put it in his A History of Civilizations, "In no society have all regions and all parts of the population developed equally." In the Austrian Empire, for example, rates of illiteracy in 1900 varied from 3% in Bohemia to 73% in Dalmatia, and per capita income in the former was nearly three times what it was in the latter during the same era. In Nigeria in 1926, only 10% of the children attending secondary school were from the northern part of the country, where a majority of the population lived. An international study of military and police forces later in the 20th century could find no multi-ethnic society in which either organization was ethnically representative of the general population. Another worldwide study of multi-ethnic societies found few, if any, which even approximated proportional representation of the different ethnic groups in different levels or sectors of the economy. The racial, ethnic, or national minorities who have owned or directed more than half of particular industries in particular nations have included not only the six groups considered here, but also the Lebanese in West Africa, Greeks in the Ottoman Empire, Britons in Argentina, Belgians in Russia, and Spaniards in Chile. In the words of Braudel, it was immigrants who created modern Brazil, modern Argentina, modern Chile. Minority predominance in particular industries and occupations has been common at local levels as well. In the early 19th century, over half the newspapers in Alexandria were owned by Syrians. In the Russian Empire in the 18th century, Armenians owned 209 of the 250 cotton cloth factories in the province of Astrakhan. Beginning in the 1960s, most of the installers of underground cable in Sydney, Australia, were Irish. In the 1990s, more than four-fifths of all the donut shops in California were owned by people of Cambodian ancestry. Sometimes it is not one specific racial, ethnic, or national group which dominates an industry or an occupation, but foreigners in general, leaving the majority population of a country a minority, or even non-existent, in whole segments of its own economy. At one period of history or another, this has been true of the majority populations of Peru, Malaya, Argentina, Switzerland, Russia, and much of the Balkans, the Middle East, and Southeast Asia. Indeed, it has been a worldwide phenomenon, found even in some economically advanced countries, as well as being common in less advanced countries. Nothing has been more common than for cities to be dominated by one ethnic group, either demographically or economically or both, while the population of the surrounding countryside has been predominantly of a different ethnic group. Examples include the long history of German dominance in Prague, Krakow, and Riga, for example, in centuries past, while the surrounding population was Czech, Polish, and Latvian, respectively. On the other side of the world, there was Chinese domination of Phnom Penh, Saigon, and Singapore, while the surrounding populations in the countryside were Cambodian, Vietnamese, and Malay. Similar patterns could be found at one time with Indians in the Kenyan capital of Nairobi or the Burmese capital of Rangoon. In military matters as well, foreigners have been disproportionately represented at all levels in many countries. From the 15th through the 17th centuries, most of the gunners aboard Portuguese warships were either Flemish or German. In the 20th century, an estimated 50% of the pilots in the Malaysian Air Force were Chinese. In the Ottoman Empire, Italians, Greeks, and Catalans manned the fleet, while Germans manned the artillery, and the elite infantry corps of the Janissaries consisted also of non-Turks in a Turkish empire. In producing military technology, foreigners brought the technology of cannons to China, Spain, and Russia, among others, and foreigners made the United States the first nuclear power. Behind such striking patterns around the world and down through history is the simple fact that skills have never been evenly or randomly distributed, whether between ethnic groups, nations, regions, or civilizations. The high level of modern optical skills developed among Germans, for example, has been apparent not only in such old German optical firms as Zeiss, Schneider, and Voigtlander, but also in the role of German immigrants and their descendants in the American optical industry. The first cameras produced by the leading American photographic company, Eastman Kodak, used lenses manufactured by the leading American optical firm, Bausch & Lomb, founded by German immigrants. A number of Kodak's top quality and highest priced cameras, notably the Retina line, were manufactured in Germany during the pre-World War II era and in the immediate post-war period. Kodak's top quality roll film camera of the mid-century decades, the Medalist, was first manufactured during World War II, when, of course, Kodak had no access to the German optical industry. However, the lens on the Medalist was a variation of a lens design created earlier in Germany. A number of American press cameras and reflex cameras in the mid-century decades used American-made Wollensack lenses, named for a German immigrant who established the company producing these lenses and other photographic equipment. The leading Swedish camera of the late 20th century, the Hasselblad, has used lenses manufactured in Germany by Zeiss. While the virtual monopoly of Germans in top-quality lenses was broken by the emergence of the Japanese as leading photographic lens manufacturers in the middle of the 20th century, nevertheless, there were few other rivals to the lens makers in these two countries. During the earlier decades, when Americans designed and produced some of the top-quality lenses, these were disproportionately Americans of German ancestry or American lenses that were variations of German lenses. During earlier centuries, the lead in optical skills was in other countries, in northern Italy during the Renaissance, for example. The point here is not that one particular country or race has had permanent possession of the leading optical skills. The point is that these skills have never been randomly or evenly distributed, but have been highly concentrated, though concentrated in different places in different centuries. Nor are optical skills peculiar in this respect. They illustrate a pattern common in many other fields. Physical settings have been no more even or random than the peoples who evolved in these settings. There are 76 mountain peaks in Asia higher than 20,000 feet, and none in Africa. More than one-third of the total land area of Europe consists of islands and peninsulas, compared to only 1% of the land area of South America. As a noted geographer has said, "Nothing in the physical or human spheres is evenly distributed. No spatula has spread human and environmental elements evenly over the face of the earth. If human and environmental elements, whether population, resources, or environmental conditions, such as climate, were uniformly distributed, then all areas and peoples of the world would have exactly the same potential. Absence of differences would eliminate trade and the necessity for exchange of goods and ideas." The geographical differences in the settings in which peoples and cultures have evolved are just one of the factors making such uniformity unlikely or impossible. Nothing has been even or random in the histories of migrating groups. Neither their geographic origins or destinations have been random, nor have the skills and aptitudes they brought with them, which have often been as specific as the points from which they originated and the points to which they moved. If there is one pattern that emerges from all these histories, it is that each group has its own cultural pattern. and that these patterns do not disappear upon crossing a border or an ocean. Nor are these patterns always coextensive with national or racial groups. Among migrants from India, for example, Tamils have not had the same experience, either at home or abroad, as Gujaratis. Southern Italians have differed from Northern Italians, whether in Argentina, Australia, the United States, or in Italy itself. Jews from Poland have had very different economic histories from the ethnic Poles, whether in Poland or overseas, and different history from those of Jews from Germany or Britain. Both hereditary and environmental explanations of group differences encounter serious problems in the light of history. Middleman minorities, such as the overseas Chinese, the Jews of the diaspora, and the overseas Indians, show some striking similarities in their experiences in a variety of nations, and yet they are racially quite distinct from one another. Other middleman minorities, such as the Koreans in the United States, the Igbos in Nigeria, or the Lebanese around the world, exhibit similar middleman characteristics while being racially distinct from each other and from the three middleman minorities studied here. Over long spans of history, the radical reshuffling of the relative technological rankings of different races and nations makes it hard to conclude that such standings are genetically determined. Not only was China as far in advance of Europe 1,000 years ago as the reverse has been true for the past few centuries, Southeastern Europe was likewise as far in advance of Northwestern Europe 2,000 years ago as the reverse has been true in the modern industrial era. Moreover, 20th century Chinese have prospered all around the world, except in China. The productivity of people of the same race has been so radically different that Chinese living outside of China were in 1994 estimated to have produced as much wealth as the entire population of China, which was of course dozens of times larger. Many environmental explanations of socioeconomic differences, that groups are what they are and have the economic fates that they do because of society, arbitrarily limit the environment to the surrounding world in which they are currently living, when the environments in which their cultures have evolved may be thousands of miles away from the society in which they now live. How much effect the existing society has is an empirical question, not a foregone conclusion. In extreme cases, slavery or genocide, for example, the prior culture of the group has had very little effect on their fate. But fortunately, such extremes are rare. Even in less extreme circumstances, such as the systematic biases against the admissions of Tamils to universities in Sri Lanka or Chinese to universities in Malaysia, the consequences have been both apparent and significant, just as similar campaigns of exclusions against Germans in Russia under Stalin or against Jews in interwar Poland took their toll. General historical patterns are suggestive, not all determining. The dogma that the immediate environment or the history of the surrounding society is virtually all that matters need not be replaced by a dogma that only internal cultural patterns matter. But the balance between them cannot be struck by any a priori formula. That is why history has to be studied and not constructed from theories. Unique events, specific leaders, passions of the moment, and accidental confluences of circumstances all make history more than a simple pattern predetermined by social, geographic, or other forces. Nevertheless, the skills, habits, and values which constitute the cultural endowment of a people usually play a powerful role in shaping the kinds of outcomes experienced by that people. The fashionable but false dichotomy between blaming the victim and blaming society ignores factors for which no blame is in order. Clearly, no one can be blamed for cultural developments which took place before he was born, or for the geographical settings in which those cultural developments took place. With most of the cities of the world being located on navigable waterways, it has been virtually inevitable that Africa would be the least urbanized continent, given its dearth of navigable rivers or natural harbors. Contrast that with the great cities of the world located at or near the terminus of great rivers emptying into the open seas, New York, London, Rotterdam, Buenos Aires, Shanghai, cities beside huge lakes or inland seas, Geneva, Chicago, Detroit, Odessa, or cities on great harbors emptying into the open seas, Sydney, Singapore, Hong Kong, San Francisco, Tokyo, Rio de Janeiro. The geographical prerequisites for such cities simply have not existed over most of the African continent, and such sites have been especially scarce south of the Sahara. It is not a matter of blame for either Africans or for the urban societies in which their descendants have found themselves in the Western Hemisphere that the kinds of urban and industrial skills which many others brought with them to the New World had not developed in most of Africa. Had Africans migrated voluntarily to the Western Hemisphere, there would still be no reason to expect the black population of the hemisphere to have the same economic history as the white population, especially since different segments of the white population have differed so sharply from one another, in part reflecting the geographical advantages and disadvantages of the particular regions of Europe from which they came. Expectations of similarity are inconsistent with the fact that differences lie at the heart of migrations. There would be no point in crossing an ocean if things were the same on both sides. There would usually be no point in incurring the high costs and high risks of migrations if everyone were equally productive where they were and where they were going. Even refugees flee because of differences in safety at different locations. When people come from different worlds, it can hardly be surprising that they differ in their new worlds. Nor can all these differences be reduced to things for which the new society can be blamed or for which policymakers can offer solutions. The past, like geography, lies beyond the reach of policymakers, though various policies may moderate or exacerbate the consequences of such factors. While societal guilt may often be as irrelevant as individual blame, many who reject the genetic inheritance of intelligence nevertheless promote the collective inheritance of guilt. A given culture is, of course, not stamped on a given people for all time, but neither does it evaporate in a few years or even in a given lifetime. Moreover, a culture is not a symbolic pattern preserved like a butterfly in amber. Its place is not in a museum, but in the practical activities of daily life, where it evolves under the stress of competing goals and other competing cultures. Cultures do not exist as simply static differences to be celebrated, but compete with one another as better and worse ways of getting things done. Better and worse, not from the standpoint of some observer, but from the standpoint of the peoples themselves, as they cope and aspire amid the gritty realities of life. To say that books have almost invariably displaced scrolls, and guns have almost invariably displaced bows and arrows, whenever a given people has had the choice, is not to say that some observer pronounces a moral benediction on either. Weapons may, of course, inflict harm. That is what makes them weapons. And so may some books, Hitler's Mein Kampf being a prime example. The point is very different, namely, that cultural relativism has neither explanatory power nor historical relevance to the way that the many and disparate peoples of the world have actually behaved. Its role is, at best, that of a polite evasion of otherwise embarrassing differences in performance and, at worst, a distraction from the task of acquiring the requisite human capital behind other people's good fortune, instead of resenting that good fortune and attributing it to exploitation of those who have had precious little to exploit. The importance of politics, and especially of protest politics, in advancing groups economically receives little or no support from the histories we have surveyed. Some of the most strikingly successful groups, such as the Germans and the Chinese, have been noted for their political apathy in countries around the world. So have Italians. Immigrants from India have been virtually invisible in American political life, even as their numbers and their prosperity have grown remarkably in the late 20th century. In a few countries, such as Australia in the 19th century and the United States in the 20th century, Jews have been prominent as elected officials. But even in these particular places and times, Jewish officials have usually been representatives of broader political constituencies rather than ethnic leaders. The Japanese overseas have been politically prominent only in Hawaii, but Japanese Americans have been even more successful economically on the mainland of the United States, where their political strength has been negligible. The election and re-election of a man of Japanese ancestry to be president of Peru in the 1990s was another case of a political leader arising as a representative of a broad constituency, not as an ethnic leader. Cultural capital. While our survey of half a dozen groups in two dozen countries represents only a modest sample of the vast numbers of groups who have migrated across the planet over the centuries, the cultural histories sketched here provide revealing glimpses of the enormous role of cultural heritages and their far-reaching implications. Cultures cover a broad spectrum of human concerns, from things as superficial as modes of dress to things as deeply felt as what one is prepared to die for. What some people think of as culture, or as high culture, art, music, literature, is only a small part of the vast spectrum of skills, values, traditions, and unarticulated habits of thought and action encompassed by a given culture. Cultures are not merely customs to which people have a sentimental attachment, or badges of identity which permit them to engage in breastfeeding. Cultures are particular ways of accomplishing the things that make life possible, the perpetuation of the species, the transmission of knowledge, and the absorption of the shocks of change and death, among other things. Cultures differ in the relative significance they attach to time, noise, safety, cleanliness, violence, thrift, intellect, sex, and art. These differences in turn imply differences in social choices, economic efficiency, and political stability. Though cultures transcend race, particular cultures are obviously often associated with particular racial and ethnic groups. Australians are Europeans, regardless of what geography may say. Not only their language and physical appearance, but also their fertility patterns, technology, philosophy, social customs, and institutions of government make them part of a culture that exists 10,000 miles away and foreign to the culture of their neighbors in Papua New Guinea or Indonesia. When cultures are seen as more than group differentiations, their role as vast accumulations of human capital can be better appreciated. To realize how Western Europe retrogressed after the collapse of the Roman Empire, and how many centuries it took to recover the economic level, the physical infrastructure, and the social and political cohesion achieved in Roman times, is to see the role of a generation or a whole race reduced to humbling perspective. After the fall of Rome, the races of Western Europe were the same as they had been before, but the dissolution of their cultural institutions left them far below the material and intellectual levels achieved by their ancestors. Cities and towns shriveled, and some disappeared. Industries vanished, law and order broke down, and in some places, illiteracy became the norm, even among the aristocracy. Medieval Europe presented a grim picture. 1,000 years ago, most of Western Europe was covered by great forests swarming with wild animals, and, according to the imagination of the people of the time, with fairies, dwarfs, and evil spirits. Marshes, too, were numerous and widespread, and in the south, the malarial mosquito created around them a depressing atmosphere of misery and death. The few towns, located within the geographical limits of the old Roman Empire, looked more like villages than towns proper, and elsewhere there were no towns at all, but only a handful of small and dirty villages. Those regions of Europe which had never been part of the Roman Empire in the first place were even less advanced. Towns were even more rare in medieval Eastern Europe than in Western Europe. The Slavs who poured into East Central Europe and the Balkans during the Middle Ages were not only illiterate, but had no written language in which they could even conceivably have been literate. The recovery of Europe from the collapse of the Roman Empire took centuries as regards some cultural aspects, but for others, it took more than 1,000 years. As late as the 19th century, there was said to be no city in Europe whose water supply was as dependable as it had been in Roman times. This massive and tragic retrogression is a sobering reminder of the enormous importance of a civilization's cultural capital as compared to the isolated ability of individuals or even the efforts and talents of a whole generation. There is no reason to doubt that individual mental capacity was as great as ever, or that as many potential geniuses were born during the darkest of the dark ages in Europe as during its eras of the most shining achievements. What was lacking was an ability to avail themselves of the great bank and capital of nations and of ages, as Burke phrased it in a different context. The institutions of such cultural transmission were simply gone with the collapse of Roman society. Conversely, a rapid accumulation of cultural capital, usually possible only by borrowing from the cultures of others, at least initially, has also produced dramatic economic and social changes. In modern times, the sudden bursting of the Scots upon the world scene as leading figures in a variety of fields of endeavor in the 18th century, after having been on the backward fringes of European civilization for many centuries, illustrates the power of cultural development. The similarly meteoric rise of Japan to the economic and technological forefront in just one century likewise shows the power of the acquisition of a new cultural capital, even in a country lacking most of the natural resources required for the spontaneous internal generation of modern industry. Whatever heartening implications such historic developments may have for the hidden potential of peoples, the implication must also be faced that that potential can remain hidden for a very long time with very serious consequences. It may sound noble to say that cultures are merely different, not better or worse in any way, and that it is all a matter of perceptions and preferences. But this argument contradicts itself by saying that one way of looking at cultural differences is better, the way of cultural relativism preferred by a fringe of contemporary intellectuals, rather than the way preferred by the vast majority of other human beings around the world and down through the centuries. These cultural differences do not matter only if cause and effect do not matter. But those who wish to be spared the devastations of diseases which have plagued the human race from time immemorial must either have the cultural capital of modern medical science themselves or have access to others who do. Smallpox, for example, continued to ravage the peoples of Eastern Europe and the Balkans long after vaccination had brought it under control elsewhere in Europe, because this was one of the many forms of cultural capital that came belatedly to these regions. Even after modern medicine became accessible to the poorer peoples of Europe, the same diseases continued to ravage poorer peoples more remote from the centers of Western medical advancement. It was not just a matter of perceptions and preferences. Widely varying amounts and kinds of cultural capital make economic and social disparities among groups and nations virtually inevitable. Yet the political temptation is to overlook the causal influences of differences in cultural capital, which often go far back into history, and instead to attribute these disparities to current failures of society. For example, the head of the leading black civil rights organization in the United States declared in 1994, "Almost half of all African American children live in poverty. Black unemployment is twice that of whites. The infant mortality rate in many black communities is equal to that of many third world nations. The statistics for housing, crime, and education deliver a tragic statement of despair and inequality. Yet in polls, more than 60% of whites say blacks now have equal opportunity." The very possibility that these disparities might be due to cultural differences affecting behavior and attitudes, or to differences in the human capital brought into the workplace, rather than to the behavior of the larger society, received no attention whatever, either in this statement or in much of the media or the academic world. Yet, when all this was being said, black American married couples with college degrees were at the same income level as white American married couples with college degrees. Even a quarter of a century earlier, black males raised in homes with books and library cards were at the same income level as white males raised in homes with similar advantages and similar education. While infant mortality rates were higher among blacks in general than among whites in general, infant mortality rates among black intact families were lower than among white female-headed families, even when those white females had more education than black females living with their husbands. In short, lifestyle differences have had major impacts on social misfortunes, though only minor impact on much thinking about those misfortunes. The issues reach beyond questions of blaming a group or assigning guilt to society. Future improvements depend upon how much of present efforts go into developing the internal resources of a group and how much into seeking political changes in the surrounding society. The implications of cultural development, as well as cultural differentiation, affect not only such issues as intergroup differences in economic progress, but also race and racism as factors in such progress. Each will be explored separately. Intergroup differences. Dramatic rises from poverty to prosperity, whether among nations or among various immigrant groups in countries around the world, undermine the notion of haves and have-nots as enduring categories of people frozen into their respective positions by social and economic forces. Indeed, the histories reviewed in the preceding chapters suggest that a more fruitful dichotomy might be between the doers and the do-nots. Since many peoples and nations have played both roles at different times in their histories, questions arise as to how and why wealth is created abundantly under some conditions and not under others. But to put that question on the agenda would be to abandon much of the intellectual and political agenda of those who focus on the distribution of wealth, as if its creation could be taken for granted, as something that happens somehow, and as if its uneven distribution, either within a given country or between nations, could only be explained by malign forces or sinister machinations. Moreover, once inherent prerequisites for producing wealth are recognized, such unevenness is neither surprising nor inherently suspect, since there is no a priori reason to expect these prerequisites to be evenly distributed. Therefore, academic standards, employment standards, and other criteria can no longer be dismissed as arbitrary impositions of barriers with disparate impact by race, class, gender, or other social groupings. While cultures compete, and while this competition results in winners and losers among the products of different cultures, this does not mean that the flesh and blood human beings whose cultural artifacts no longer remain functional are necessarily losers in the process. On the contrary, in many cases, they gain a higher standard of living and a wider cultural exposure, which they themselves come to value and embrace. Again, this represents not simply the values of an observer, but the preferences revealed by the behavior of the people concerned, as they abandon their own traditional ways of doing particular things in favor of ways they have discovered in the cultures of others. Nor is this a particularly modern development. The earliest known civilizations borrowed extensively from one another. Thousands of years before Christ, metallurgical techniques from the Middle East diffused into the steppes of Central Asia. Horseback riding techniques and musical instruments developed in Central Asia spread to China, and a great variety of products and processes flowed from China to the West over the centuries. Gunpowder, paper, printing, porcelain, silk, canal locks, wheelbarrows, rudders for boats and ships, and playing cards, for example. In the other direction, art styles from ancient Greece and Rome made their way along the Silk Road to China. The culture of ancient Korea was almost all of Chinese origin. Happy endings are, of course, not guaranteed in all cultural encounters. Some groups have been oppressed in many ways for many generations, or even centuries, because they would not give up their cultures. This was the fate of the Jews in Europe and Central Asians under both the Tsars and the Communists. The point here is not to assess whether most cultural competition ends happily or unhappily, but rather to indicate that the competition of cultures takes place both within societies and between societies. Cultures compete at many levels. They compete most obviously in warfare, for the outcomes of wars of conquest can determine what language the descendants of the combatants will speak for centuries to come, what concepts will organize their thoughts, and what values will shape their moral universe. The Western Hemisphere is an outpost of European civilization because Europeans won the wars of conquest in this part of the world. Today, even those in the Western Hemisphere who hate European civilization express that hatred in a European language and denounce it as immoral by European standards of morality. The alternatives they propose likewise tend to follow European concepts. Pan-Africanism, for example, is not an African concept, but a European concept applied to Africa, paralleling such notions as Pan-Slavism and Pan-Germanism, but having little in common with the strong local and tribal loyalties of Africa. A whole generation of post-independence African leaders, educated in Europe and the United States, has proclaimed the ideology of Pan-Africanism, while having their hands full trying to hold together countries torn apart by internal tribal rivalries. Wars are only one of the ways in which cultures compete. More continuously and more pervasively, they compete in the many practical ways that cultures serve human purposes, from the growing of food to trying to understand the motions of the stars. Agricultural methods and astronomy are just two of many features taken over by one culture from another and spread around the world. Yet, even when one culture supersedes another, seldom is it more satisfactory in every way, so that laments for the lost virtues of abandoned cultures have been both common and understandable. But there is no need for nostalgia to corrupt history or for rejected cultural artifacts to be resurrected at public expense, much less imposed on others for obligatory admiration. Above all, there is no need to encourage those who have progressed by cultural borrowings to retrogress by painting themselves into their own cultural corner and taking upon themselves the arduous burden of advancing solely by what their own subgroup can accomplish in isolation from the wider world, which has long been the cultural resource of peoples, nations, and whole civilizations. Migrations have long been part of the process of cultural diffusion. However, intergroup differences present not only an opportunity for cultural interchanges and economic advancement, but also for negative consequences, ranging from social frictions to the spread of disease to the disintegration of whole societies. Even immigrant groups contributing greatly to the economic development of the countries to which they go may also harbor criminal elements in their midst, whose depredations and corruption of law enforcement agencies affect the larger surrounding society. The Tongs among the overseas Chinese and the Mafia among Italian immigrants have been obvious examples. International terrorists hiding among Muslim immigrant populations in Europe and the United States are more recent examples. Diseases have long been spread by migrations. 19th century emigrants from Russia, for example, often departed on transatlantic voyages from the German port of Bremen, and in 1892 they brought a devastating cholera epidemic with them to Bremen, killing nearly 10,000 people. Earlier in the century, caravans from Central Asia brought cholera into Europe, where the population had less resistance than in parts of Asia where the disease was endemic. In East Africa as well, movements of people, in this case slaves, often spread both cholera and smallpox along their routes, as they were forcibly marched from where they were captured to where they would be sold, through areas inhabited by various other peoples. Perhaps the most disastrous of all disease-spreading migrations was that of Europeans to the Western Hemisphere, annihilating by disease the majority of the indigenous population, and in some places such as the Caribbean, virtually all of the indigenous population. Nor has the modern era been immune to the biological consequences of the movements of people from different disease environments. The United States in the late 20th century found various diseases which had become virtually extinct in the American population suddenly resurgent as they were reintroduced by immigrants from countries where such diseases were still prevalent, tuberculosis, leprosy, measles, cholera, and malaria, for example. Internal migrations have also spread diseases at various times and places throughout history, especially when refugees fleeing epidemics have spread the epidemic to others. Animals, as well as human beings, are struck by diseases transmitted through migration. One diseased ewe brought into Northumberland from Spain in the 13th century has been blamed for a spread of murrin in Britain that lasted more than a quarter of a century. Rinderpest, which struck Western Europe in the 18th century, killing vast numbers of cattle, later spread into parts of Africa, with similarly devastating results for both wild and domesticated animals there. From another perspective, however, the transportation of animals to environments where their usual predators are lacking and the usual animal diseases less prevalent has often led to higher than usual survival rates. More favorable conditions in new lands have also had similarly beneficial effects on the health and survival of plants and human beings. Wheat in the Delaware Valley, sheep in New Zealand, and Britons in Massachusetts, Australia, and New Zealand all thrived better than in their native lands. Among the many cross-currents of positive and negative consequences of migrations are frictions among peoples with different cultural backgrounds, priorities, taboos, and imperatives. From differences in the way that people look at each other, to differences in the way they respond to noise or dispose of their garbage, immigrants may differ from the peoples of their host countries. A sufficiently cohesive group of foreigners may even pose a threat to the territorial integrity of the nation in which they settle. Americans who settled in parts of Mexico in the early 19th century agreed to accept the laws, language, religion, and citizenship of that country, but in fact later revolted, seceded, and eventually joined that part of Mexican territory to the United States. In ancient times, the peaceful settlement of barbarians in parts of the Roman Empire was a prelude to their later attacks on the empire that brought it down in ruins. The entire modern state of Israel was created as a result of demands and insurrections by a population that had largely immigrated to that part of the Middle East within the previous century. The question here is not whether these particular events were good or bad developments. The point is that immigration can profoundly affect the fabric of a society and even dissolve the ties that hold a nation together. The demands of immigrants need not be territorial to be divisive or disruptive. Indeed, it need not even be the immigrants themselves who make demands. In Britain and British offshoot nations, such as the United States, Canada, and Australia, ideological proponents of multiculturalism among the native populations have promoted sweeping ranges of programs aimed at preserving foreign cultures and languages, often with more than a hint of hostility to the institutions and traditions of the host country. In the United States, many immigrants are legally entitled to preferential treatment under affirmative action programs set up ostensibly to remedy historic wrongs that occurred before contemporary immigrants arrived. Both multiculturalism and affirmative action programs thus add to the cost of absorbing immigrants, not least by increasing the resentment of them by the native population. Government-provided benefits in general have made immigrants more costly to absorb, quite aside from the question whether they cause more immigrants to come or reduce the selectivity of the immigrant population by including many without the initiative or ambition of those who immigrated when there was little or no help available from government. Anti-immigrant feelings and movements have grown in the welfare states of Western Europe and the United States. Unfortunately, among ideological zealots who have promoted immigrants as a symbolic cause, this resentment by the masses may only confirm their own sense of moral superiority, rather than serving as a warning that the combination of lax immigration laws, welfare state benefits, and schemes to keep foreigners foreign are leading to potentially explosive conflicts. These social conflicts may be especially tragic in an era when persecutions and armed conflicts around the world are producing vast numbers of refugees seeking asylum, but discovering that such asylum is increasingly difficult to find. The human tragedies caused by turning away desperate people from borders are made doubly tragic when much of the opposition comes not simply from objections to the immigrants themselves, but also from objections to the social and political agendas being promoted by ideologues who use the immigrants as part of their general opposition to the values and traditions of their own society. Just as there are both positive and negative consequences of immigration, the immigrants themselves differ greatly. Fewer than 5% of the immigrants from Britain or Germany went on welfare after arriving in late 20th century America. But more than one-fourth of the immigrants from Vietnam and nearly half of those from Cambodia did. Again, domestic ideological agendas may make it impossible to be selective in admitting immigrants from different nations, leaving as alternatives only loss of control of the borders or restrictive policies toward immigrants in general. The past and the future. The historic role of migrations in spreading skills, technology, and manpower from where they are abundant to where they are more scarce has been monumental in its consequences. However, such achievements have not come merely from the movement of bodies. It has been the movement of knowledge, of skills, and of technology that has been crucial. What the passage of time and the development of modern industry and instant electronic communications has done has been to make the transmission of knowledge, skills, and technology less and less dependent on the transportation of bodies, all the while making such transportation so inexpensive as to permit larger migrations over greater distances of immigrants who may be less and less selective. Whether they are in fact less selective may be difficult to determine, especially when the crucial selectivity in terms of ambition and perseverance are unquantifiable, and selectivity in terms of education is ambiguous in some cases. Immigrants to the United States during the 1980s, for example, having rising numbers of years of schooling but falling further behind the years of schooling of Americans, which was rising faster. Moreover, it would be a great mistake to equate formal schooling with human capital. Many of the immigrants who helped bring whole nations into the modern commercial world, the Lebanese in West Africa and the Chinese in Southeast Asia, for example, arrived with little or no formal education. Conversely, much schooling produces no skills, however much it may expand expectations, contributing to political instability in some third world countries especially. Whatever the empirical facts about the quality of immigrants may be in particular countries in particular years, the transportation of bodies and the dissemination of human capital have become increasingly separable operations, so that the historic role of immigration in advancing nations need not apply to its future role. Those countries with the most human capital to contribute to the rest of the world have tended to send fewer and fewer emigrants abroad, so that nothing resembling the massive migrations from Japan and Germany in earlier generations existed by the late 20th century. Refugees with valuable human capital, such as the Jews or the Huguenots in the past, have migrated simply to escape persecution, thereby benefiting the recipient countries, whether the Ottoman Empire, Switzerland, England, or the United States. But many refugees have no such human capital, and refugees to the United States in the late 20th century tended to stay on welfare longer than either American citizens or other kinds of immigrants. In short, international migrations have tended to become a less and less effective way of transferring human capital, at least as compared to alternatives that have emerged or grown in importance. One alternative way of sharing the human capital of the world has been international trade and the setting up of businesses in each other's countries. Japan, for example, has permitted virtually no immigration, but has become one of the leading international trading nations of the world, and has also set up Japanese businesses, turning out Japanese products produced by Japanese methods in countries around the world. As of 1992, for example, Toyota produced more than 345,000 cars in the United States, and Honda more than 450,000. Meanwhile, only about half of General Motors' worldwide passenger car output was being produced in the United States. Neither technological nor managerial human capital requires mass immigration for its diffusion. Even in centuries past, sojourners have played crucial roles in the economic development of nations without remaining to become permanent residents. When Britain was the leading industrial nation of the world, its technicians and engineers took its technology to Germany and the United States in the early 19th century and to Japan later in that century, providing the foundation for the later rise of each of these nations to major positions as industrial powers that later eclipsed Britain itself. In many other countries as well, British railroads and British textile machinery became standard from India to Africa to South America. Sojourners from various nations have also gone to Britain, and in a later era to the United States, Germany, and other industrial nations, to acquire the human capital needed to advance their own countries economically. This human capital has been not only in the form of technological knowledge, but has also included knowledge of the science behind the technology, and the organizational skills needed to turn technology into products and produce these products in economically viable enterprises. Moreover, once a sufficient human capital has been transferred to another nation in this way, its own people can train others at home while staying abreast of international developments. One of the historically important ways of transferring human capital by immigration has been by the return of sojourners bearing knowledge, skills, and attitudes acquired during their stays in more advanced societies. This, however, makes a stronger case for the sending countries to permit emigrants to leave freely than for recipient countries to allow immigrants to enter freely. This method of transferring human capital has, if anything, become more important over time. During the late 20th century, the proportion of PhDs awarded to foreigners by universities in the United States increased in a variety of fields, but particularly in mathematics and engineering. As of 1993, American citizens received only 39% of the doctorates in engineering awarded in the United States. In addition to transfers of technology by education, specialized books and journals, multinational corporations, international computer networks, consulting firms, and government agencies all facilitate the international transfer of human capital without the need for permanent resettlement. The history of immigration in all its various forms is an important part of the history of the advancement of the human race. The causes and consequences of immigration remain relevant for the present and future, even where mass immigration itself is no longer an urgent priority for the recipient countries, now that less costly and less socially disruptive ways of transferring human capital have become more feasible. The history of immigrants who began in poverty and achieved prosperity, while at the same time advancing the economic level of the society around them, brings into sharper focus the importance of creating wealth, especially important when so many are preoccupied with its distribution. Such immigrants have left a legacy not only of economic examples, but also of human inspiration.